Welcome to this edition of the Hagmann Report. It is the 16th day of August 2017. You know, it was August 9th of 1970. What was it, 74? August 9th. When Nixon resigned, you look at the headlines, and the reason I mention this is because you look at the headlines, and like Stephen Mayking had said, I'm making a leap here, a big leap, but there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of stuff churning under the surface. I don't think anyone in their right mind of rational sense, of normal sensibilities would look at what's going on today and say, you know, everything's okay. It's not okay. There's a move to censure President Trump. A move to censure him. Now think about that, okay? That process, the censuring process, is done for not this. And it's ridiculous in its face. McCain, of course, pulling back. Others, the Republican so-called base that really was never there before, is pulling out and distancing themselves from Trump. Where do you think this is going to end up? Do you see anywhere good where this? Do you see any good coming from this? And where is it all starting, or where is it from? There's nothing good that will come from this. And this all started, as Stephen Mayking said, I believe, and is continuing with this color revolution. I got to tell you something, quite frankly, I'm extremely nervous. The fact that the Obama, Washington machinery is still hanging out. I'm extremely nervous about that. I'm very nervous about the, about this whole situation. And after reading our guest that's coming up here, Utopian Road to Hell, and if I said, it's William J. Murray. If I said William T., I apologize. It's William J. Murray, Utopian Road to Hell. After reading this and taking a look back through history and seeing where we're at and seeing the objectives and the agenda of the people in power around Donald Trump, ladies and gentlemen, I honestly don't think I've ever been this concerned about the fate of our nation, even with Obama at the helm. And that says a lot. Because right now, Donald Trump has few friends. And the media, of course, has been weaponized against Donald Trump. It's being used as a weapon. Everything has been weaponized against not just Donald Trump, the president, but the presidency, the institution, the government, the no confidence or the lack of confidence in the government. And, of course, it's a strike against, a blow against, in my view anyway, the movement that brought Donald Trump to this place at this point in time. I'll tell you this flat out. I see, and Joe, and correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, look, I think you and I are both on the same page. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the statements he did or did not make.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Right.
And if I want to know if there's anybody out there that's listening that disagrees, send an email to studio at HagmannandHagmann.com, right, and tell us where and how you disagree. And, you know, we've seen the media's reaction is one thing that we continue to cover because it's so far removed from reality. You know, from Don Lemon saying Trump supporters are racist because he's a white supremacist now. You have Michael Eric Dyson. He's a prominent left-wing commentator for race issues. He says, you know, these left-wing hate groups such as Black Lives Matter and Antifa are preserving the fabric of America. While CNN is gung-ho in its relentless coverage and criticism of Tuesday's press conference, the network's apparently not as interested in correcting the liberal guest's less-than-accurate characterizations of violent left-wing groups. And he's not the only one, this Eric Dyson. You know, you had Van Jones also making comments that, you know, these are people were fighting fascism. And you have CNN guest saying the GOP today are slave owners in bed with neo-Nazis. And more and more and more, I mean, all these react. I like to go to newsbusters.org to see the reactions of the news media. They pretty much sum it up really nicely when something like this is going on. MSNBC, Trump prompt Elaine Chao complicit in white supremacy. I mean, where are these people getting it from?
It's beyond.
They're making it up as they go. This is a scripted agenda. They had these talking points and this agenda, this narrative, ready for an event like this, or they created it on the fly. But the top leaders in business, politics, and media are sticking to it, and that's what's concerning because it's so far removed from reality.
Well, you know, the title of tonight's program is The Utopian Road to Hell.
Are we there yet?
And you know, we are speeding down that road very quickly. And the guest that we have on, I'm so honored to have him on, honored to speak with him, is William J. Murray. He is the chairman of the Religious Freedom Coalition in Washington, D.C. For more than 30 years, he has been at the forefront of social conservatism. Now, I'm going to tell you that he has appeared on all the top, all the network stations, from CNN, ABC, CBS, Fox News, and so on, all the news programs, and has authored hundreds of columns, appearing online and in print in various publications. I couldn't name them all. He continues to work for the rights of Christians in America and the persecuted Christians around the world. He's got a number of different organizations. What William J. Murray does for Christians around the world is, I think, unparalleled by anyone. He has, again, the religiousfreedomcoalition.org. He also has christmasforrefugees.org and diapersforrefugees.org, and the 4 is the actual number 4. And of course, diapersforrefugees.org assists only Christians in the Middle East, and all those assist Christians in the Middle East, that is to say. But here's the real skinny in the very quickly. And we are going to forego at the bottom of the hour break, so to give Mr. Murray that complete time. When I read the book Utopia Road to Hell, I was absolutely blown away. And everyone knows I like books, and I say that about just about every book that I read, that, you know, I like it. But this book is special and it's different. In fact, this is going to be required reading for everyone in the office, because Mr. Murray lays out, he describes the totalitarians throughout history. In my view, in order to understand what's going on today, you've got to look back at history through the lens and the context of history. And he describes not only the previous totalitarians, but the current utopians who are determined to control the lives of every person on this planet. That's right. From vicious tyrants, you got Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot, and to the social engineering of Woodrow Wilson and Barack Obama, Mr. Murray masterfully educates readers in this book about the utopian swath of destruction in history, and warns us of the dangers of present-day utopians, and there are many fighting to hold power. Did you get that? To hold power. And I think that we're seeing a lot take place here, that grasping for power is at the root of what we're seeing a lot of today. He wrote a column, as a matter of fact, it's right here. He's talking about his tour, or his trip to Cuba. And this is, and we're going to post it's in westernjournalism.com, but we're going to post the link in the description. It's a fascinating article. And so I asked if he would come on, and he has kindly said yes, to talk about the essence of his book, kind of a thumbnail sketch, and then what's going on in Venezuela, and also what he experienced in Cuba. But with that, welcome William J. Murray. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be on the program with you tonight.
Well, it's great to have you. And I do want to mention, folks, Mr. Murray's book is available for sale at the WND Superstore. Just use promo code Hagman. That's superstore.wnd.com. Promo code Hagman. I'm going to tell you something, Mr. Murray. I learned things in your book, and I've talked about, or I've read a lot about the various characters and the various movements and the objectives. But this is one of the most thorough examinations of utopian tyrants throughout history. And I just want to congratulate you on a fine book. I'm not even sure where to start, except can you tell us a little bit about the book itself and about your writing it? I mean, it's a kind of a unique topic to write on.
Well, yes, it is. And probably the most interesting part about it is that I was raised and educated by the people that promote the utopian society. I was a red diaper baby, and by the way, if you'll ask him, Joe Farah was also a red diaper baby. There's a lot of us around. And I was raised in that Marxist environment. My Sunday school classes were Marxist-Leninist classes. They weren't on Sunday, of course. They were on a weeknight. And I knew and understood the theory. And I can understand how people, and particularly this new millennial generation that doesn't experience hard labor, and who is raised in a kind of coddled snowflake existence. And by that, I'm not talking about the working class and the young men and women that have to go out and get jobs as waiters and waitresses at 16, 17, 18 years old. But I'm talking about the coddled class that promotes this utopian idea. I can understand how they can get hooked on it very easily. On paper, it sounds great. On paper, it works. In the environment that I was raised in, on paper, it looked great. The problem is the application. And we could give some very, very dramatic examples. One of the greatest of which is when it was tried by the pilgrims when they got here, and there was no private ownership, and everything was common property, and everybody worked in the field as hard as they could, and they brought in whatever they could, and they put it in a big communal pot, and then they were supposed to only take out what they needed, and the result was starvation. They almost starved to death. Fortunately, after the first year, the governor intervened, declared private property. People worked their own little plot of land, and of course, the colony immediately became successful. That is kind of the condensed story of the utopian idea, the collectivist utopian idea of from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And notice I didn't say want, and Marx didn't say want, and utopians don't say they want, say want. It's according to your need. It's sort of like Obamacare. We're going to prescribe to you the medical treatment and the medical insurance that you need. It might necessarily be what you want. It might not be what you can pay for, but it's what we believe that you need. It's that whole giant pot theory. Everybody works hard, puts everything they can, everything in the pot for the good of the collective society, but people only take out what they need. Unfortunately, somebody forgot to tell 2-year-old children about this, and they grab as much as they can.
Yeah, exactly. Very well said. Wow. Are we, Mr. Murray, are we, based on everything you've and your grasp of or your explanation, I shouldn't say grasp, but your explanation spoke to me directly. I mean, intellectually, it was just a fantastic read. Are we on this utopian road to hell right now? What we're seeing right now, we've seen this before in history many times, but can you kind of contextualize current events with your analysis that you have in your book, is in terms of this utopian road to hell, where we're at right now with this concept?
Well, it's sort of like the frog in the proverbial warm water that you put on the stove and he never jumps out as it boils. We have been going through decades of this road, and there has been some variance. Occasionally we have had a few leaders or Congress come along that has stalled the forward movement of it, but it has just chugged along. The greatest advance of it, of course, was with Woodrow Wilson and Colonel House and the advent of the federal income tax, which stole the influence of the states, and then, of course, the constitutional amendment, which eliminated the Senate representing the states any longer at all because of the direct election. They're not appointed by governors, so they no longer represent the states. They represent the people just like the Congress does, and it ripped apart the fabric of the republic. And it continued to lead us down a road where we have a small a handful of elitists that are able to get together and decide the future of the nation. What's really dangerous about it, I think, today is now we have a billionaire class that we never had before that has really gotten together and decided that they can be that small group. I want to go back a little bit because all the way back to Plato. Plato was the one who started this the very concept of you have a small number of well-trained, and he wrote about this well-trained and well-educated elitist that can decide for everyone. And this concept over and over and over again has appeared in history. Every time that it has appeared, every time that it has been tried, it has been an absolute disaster. People do not, in the long run, want to cooperate with it. They don't want their belongings taken. They don't want forced into certain jobs or certain education. And when they don't, inevitably, this wonderful utopian idea has to be turned into an instrument of force in order to force people to go along with the small group of intellectuals who are guiding it. And we've seen it over and over again, and we see it happening now in the alleged democracies in Europe, where if a political party like came along in Greece, the Conservative Party, came along and started to get influence. There was an immigrant killed near a train station, and the intellectuals that control the ruling parties there used as an example to arrest and jail the leaders of that party, outlaw the party because it was gaining too much influence. And we see this happening again and again throughout Europe. We saw the vilification of Marine Pen, the censorship, the horrendous censorship that goes on, so that many opinions are not allowed to be shared publicly because they're declared hate speech. So yes, we have that march, and we have it socially, we have it economically, we see the government controlling more and more of the economy, and when that happens, the sphere of liberty that Friedrich Hayek talked about begins to shrink. And then socially, we see the control of the society of this kind of utopian thing. We're going to control your children. We're going to control your habits. We're going to control your social the social aspects of your life until you conform to this this thing that we want that we think can bring about this perfect perfect world. Again, totally ignoring the nature of humanity.
Very interesting. And by extension, and I'm glad you went back to Plato, and I think it's important to understand the road, the utopian road to hell is a long one. And I mean that by going back in history, of course, and William Murray does go back and to really going back to the satanic influence in utopian tyrannies, to Sir Thomas More's utopian such, Sparta and Plato's Republic inspired utopian tyrants. Very interesting works, all. I mean, very interesting chapters, that is. Let me ask this question, because I've been hearing this a lot more and more lately. The phrase cultural Marxists. Now, in your book, you've got a chapter called Cultural Utopians. Same thing? cultural?
Yeah, it really is. The cultural utopians, first of all, the reason I use the word utopian in the whole concept and the whole idea of the book is there are many different faces have come along to create some kind of a utopian existence, and we tend to separate them. For instance, we tend to separate communism and fascism. We tend to look at Stalin and Hitler as two different things, one on the right and one on the left. Actually, they weren't. They were exactly the same thing. They both envisioned a small group of people coming together, being able to establish a utopian society for their people and ultimately the whole world. The only difference between communism, the radical communism of the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin, and the National Socialism of Adolf Hitler was the means to get there and what you called it. People forget Hitler was a socialist. When he came in, 50% of the means of production was seized by the government. Suddenly people didn't own their entire business. They owned half of it. With communism, all of this went to the government. Hitler used the slaughter of the Jews in order to finance his thousand-year Reich, and where did all the Autobahn and all this army and great army and all this technology came from? It came from robbing 7 million Jews. It just wasn't about anti-Semitism. It was about theft. The theft of tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. Even the clothes of the Jews and their gold teeth were stolen in order to finance the construction of his utopia for the Aryan race. On the communist side, the same thing. Confiscation. And the killing of the gentry, all the army officers, the seizing of property, the exile. We talk about, Hitler killed, I think 8 or 9 million people, including the Jews, and robbed from them, Joseph Stalin and Lenin. They probably killed 20 or 30 million in order to do the same thing. So it isn't two different things, and we can give all these different names, and we can give the social utopians in the United States and in the Western world a different name too, but in actuality, they are one thing. There are people that believe that they are so smart and that they have such great wisdom that they can create a village, Hillary Clinton style, that they can create the village that can, a small group of highly trained and wonderful intellectuals and intelligent people that can create a society that benefits all. And of course, what it really benefits is them. If you look at Thomas More's utopia, everybody was allowed a certain amount of food except the leaders. They got more. The same thing in Plato's Republic. In Russia, the communists had their own hotel system, their own medical system. They were separate from everybody else, and the same was true of the Nazis.
Exactly. And as I was reading this, I thought of today, as I read the book, it was before the violence we saw this past weekend, but I can formulate my question now after reading this. My question, I guess, is this: where we're at today with what we're seeing, regardless of the violence or the recent violence, just the total landscape, the political landscape, it seems to me, and please correct me if I am incorrect about this, it seems to me the groups, the individuals who are responsible for the violence we're seeing today, this push toward this collectivism, they are responsible for what we're seeing today. I mean, I believe that. And the pushback is, of course, the whiplash, the cultural whiplash, I call it. And I was talking on my radio, my morning show this morning, I was talking about the difference between Obama and Trump, and the result, the difference between the two has caused this cultural whiplash, but because where we were on before, the road was straight toward this utopian hell. Now, Donald Trump has come forth and put a stop to that, or put a bend in the road, and of course, you know, causing us whiplash. Is that a correct assessment? I mean, how would you equate, if at all, or explain what we're seeing in terms of violence today?
You know, that's an interesting question. Nobody blamed Barack Obama for Ferguson, Missouri,
right,
or Baltimore, Maryland. And nobody, there were racists involved in that too. But there is a similarity that I think everybody is missing here. And it does have to do with cultural purity, which is another issue. And it has to do with our college campuses and things. But there is another issue here. The people, the blacks of Ferguson, the blacks of Baltimore, the African Americans, felt like they rioted because they felt like they were being repressed and that somebody was given an advantage over them. Now, let me cause us now great grief and horrible trolling by internet snipers. What happened in Charlottesville was identical. The riot there was by a group of individuals who felt underprivileged and targeted and felt like they had been taken, things had been taken away from them, and that they were not being treated equally. You know, everyone that is involved in this argument in Washington D.C. Has an income of two or three times the national median. And is highly educated or has IQs of 130 or 140, and they forget that that many particularly white men from working class neighborhoods from the mining areas and from rural areas have been deprived of a college education, deprived of higher education and jobs, simply because of their intellectual level and because of their lack of education in those types of environments. They have been denied jobs because of their race and their sex. That's a harsh thing to say. But for a lot of working class white men, not necessarily the white women because they get points to go into the schools, into the colleges, but they feel that opportunity has been taken away from them and given to people that are less deserving because of the color of those other people's skin. Now, to a certain extent, from their point of view, there is certain truth in that. If you have a lower SAT score and you don't have money to get into a private university and you are a white male and there's a white female or a black male or a black female or somebody else, they are going to get the slot that you are not going to get. And the same thing is true of jobs at big corporations. That is part of the cultural utopianism, the cultural Marxism, where people are not allowed to compete based on their abilities, that all kind of other markers are thrown in there in order to make it a more just society. Now, believe me, I believe that there has been repression in the African American community. I believe that the ghettos, that there's very poor opportunities to advance and be educated and that additional opportunities might have to be offered. But what I'm explaining is the perspective of those that congregated in Charlotte. Their perspective is that they are being treated and repressed in exactly the same manner as the blacks of the Baltimore ghetto.
Interesting analysis. And I think maybe that's the first time I've heard it explained or put in that context. Very interesting analysis. Okay. And I can see that. I can see that, and I can see the similarities, much like, we'll say Ferguson, at least on that mentality. So, very good. And our guest, folks, is William J. Murray. He's the author of a number of books, but, by far my favorite book, I've read in a long time, Utopian Road to Hell. Folks, this is required reading as far as I'm concerned, everyone here at the office. And you can get it at WND Superstore. use the promo code Hagman. I highly encourage you to do this. You'll learn what's going on today by reading this book. But I certainly want to make sure that we talk about a couple of things before our time is up. One being your trip to Cuba, another being your analysis of Venezuela, but most importantly, before you leave, we've got to talk about your organizations and the good that you're doing all across the world. So I want to leave time for that. Can I ask you, or at this point, what is going on in Venezuela? What does the average person need to know about what's taking place?
It's a utopian dream world. What can I say? Everyone has to keep in mind. Now, just put this in perspective. Venezuela has the largest known petroleum reserves in the world. They have more known petroleum than Saudi Arabia. Now, just think about this. Think about this. The Saudis own downtown London. The Saudis own huge sections of the best sections of Manhattan. They own part of Fox News. They've bought into Hollywood. One of their sheiks owned his own private giant Airbus 380 with a swimming pool on it.
Oh my.
Excuse me. They own the largest yachts in the world. They have the third largest military budget in the world. Third largest military budget in the world. Russia is, I think, fourth or fifth or something like that. And Venezuela, with the largest known oil petroleum reserves in the world, is flat broke. Flat broke. And the people are starving. The average Venezuelan has lost between 10 or 12 pounds over the last 5 years. There is no food available. There is rationing. The currency is probably worth about as much as Monopoly money. This wasn't a third world country, by the way, when Chavez took power. Just about everybody had a Bank of America card. The country was very, very, middle class, modern malls, modern infrastructure. The oil was producing, there was revenue, there was wealth in the community. And then Chavez came in and decided to make people more equal. And now they're all equal. They are miserably poor and starving to death. I want to add one criticism to this, though. I want to put some responsibility where it is. This happened in Honduras, and it happened in Venezuela. In Honduras, they impeached the president when he did this, when he decided to take over. The Congress impeached him and got rid of him. The Bush administration ordered them to take him back. Were there going to be sanctions? They said, forget it. We're not taking this turkey back. We're not going to have a president for life. Forget it. They're a free country today. In Venezuela, the Bush administration, when he was impeached and arrested and deported from the country, the Bush administration intervened and said, oh, you're thwarting democracy. The impeachment, that was democracy in action. They were getting rid of a dictator who wanted a life. Our government, the United States of America, intervened and forced the people of Venezuela and the Congress to take this guy back. People should just look up the history of this. I would like to say that everything that happened down there, this happened because it happened within Venezuela, but unfortunately we're not totally innocent in this matter. The situation is horrible, and a lot of it comes from fixed prices. I worked in Russia for a while. We had a ministry operation there. We established the first Bible publishing company, and I could very explain what happened in Russia. People think Ronald Reagan ran the place out of business by increasing military spending. That's not what happened. I love Ronald Reagan, but it isn't what happened. The country went bankrupt from providing goods and services for less money than they cost. A loaf of bread was a nickel, even though it cost 65, 70 cents to produce. The ride in the Moscow subway was a few pennies. because everything was kept, oh, we have to keep it cheap for the people. We have to keep it cheap for the people. We have to satisfy the people. The same thing is happening in Venezuela to create their utopia. They set the food prices. Well, the bread companies couldn't buy enough wheat. So the government bought, took over the wheat companies, and then the farmers couldn't produce it for that. So they took over, and they just kept taking over more and more and more, as this simply wouldn't work. You cannot sell a product for less than it costs to make, even if you are a government. You can't do it. But in order to create this mindset of utopianism, you have to have these set prices and pretend that you can keep these prices lower, even when doing that causes the goods and services not to be available at all. And that has caused a death spiral in Venezuela from what literally was a, like a little Switzerland in South America, almost a little Switzerland, has turned into one of the worst economic basket cases. To the point that they're selling their oil futures to the Chinese for pennies on the dollar to get some cash. And the Chinese will be very happy to pump oil there for the next 10 years for free.
Yeah, I've read some of your writings about this. Absolutely incredible. And, you know, people think, oh, this can't happen. What happened in Venezuela cannot happen in America, of course. But the context, certainly, that you've given, given the fact that third largest, the numbers that you gave, I mean, certainly proves that it most assuredly can happen here in America if the wrong decisions are made. What was not too long ago, and Joe, you had mentioned this on air, President Trump was, or at least our government was saying something about, intervening militarily in Venezuela. Mr. Murray, what are they referencing there? Was it kind of an extension of the Bush doctrine, if you will?
I can't even imagine. It's a well-armed nation. Maybe he was talking about helping to get people out. I mean, Bush Sr. did go into Panama and rapidly clean up what was a drug cartel, but we left and it was turned back over to the people very rapidly.
Right.
I don't know that that could happen in Venezuela yet. It is a very difficult situation. The country, unfortunately, just can't flip over and die and go bankrupt because of the tremendous amount of oil that it has. So the people are going to suffer probably through a civil war is more than likely what is going to happen next. I was recently in Cuba and you know, saw some of the outcome there, and it is the same. I wrote a column about my tour guide being
Please talk about this.
My tour guide was an attorney. The first tour guide, I had three tour guides. The first one was an attorney. The second one was attorney. And the third one was an aviation engineer and commercial airline pilot. Because these were the best jobs they could get. Virtually everybody in Cuba has a college education. But the problem is that there's simply no jobs for what they're educated for. It is sort of like, I don't know if you've got it there, but we've got the Wawa. It was like a 7-Eleven. You go in there, there's people, there's young grads, the people with grad, with college degrees in there, they're running the cash register. We're educating people for positions that are unneeded or that are unobtainable. And in Cuba, it was far worse, where there was universal education through college. So everybody has some kind of a degree, and the only good paying jobs there now are in tourism. So the people that are very, very well educated are gravitating back toward tourism rather than being in a lawyer or an aviation engineer or something of that nature. The situation in Cuba after decades and decades and decades of this utopian dream, incredibly bad. It's just incredibly bad. It is third world, and there's no reason for it to be third world, considering its location the agriculture is gone. We went through, went by factory after factory after factory that was shut. The people really have nothing except their hand. By the way, Cuban cigars, don't buy any Cuban cigars. You're probably buying Honduran tobacco. They ruined the tobacco fields, and they ship in tobacco now and hand roll the cigars there and sell them as Cuban cigars. So it's let the buyer beware.
Boy, now that's a problem, okay? Because I'm a cigar man, but thanks for that tip, by the way. All right, wow. Well, what you saw in Cuba, and you explained it pretty well. I mean, the article, by the way, is from April 27th, but it's relevant, still relevant today. WesternJournalism.com, education for all. In Cuba, my tour guide is a lawyer. Fantastic article that you've written. Time is running so short. Mr. Murray, again, thank you for coming on. Your book, Utopian Road to Hell, thanks for writing that. But before you leave, before the top of the hour here, we've got to talk about your current endeavors in with your various organizations. Which one do you want to start with? Because you've got a number, and I think they're all just
the Religious Freedom Coalition is the blanket organization, and the others are really not organizations; they're projects of the Religious Freedom Coalition. And we do a lot of work on Capitol Hill. We're working on H.R. 390 now, which is a bill not only condemning the genocide of Christians in the Middle East, but basically reordering how the aid is given, because with a treaty that we're a part of, we are supposed to be helping the victims of genocide first, not those who perpetrate genocide and then having the victim last in line, which has been the case for the last 8 years. And then in the Middle East, we're working to help those victims of genocide who happen to be the Christians, particularly the Iraq and the Assyrian Christians. And we have several programs over there. Two of our biggest are Diapers for Refugees, where we deliver, diapers to, the families who have been not necessarily refugees, but displaced if they're in the same country. We deliver diapers to those. It's one of those things that we chose because it wasn't being taken care of by any other aid group. We do large Christmas programs for the children where they're brought in out of the freezing cold in Iraq and in Jordan, where they're refugees, and in Lebanon, and we give them a basically half day program trying to reskill the imagery of Christmas and what it's about, and the gospel stories, gospel puppet shows, gospel music, coloring books, the kind of a meal that they're used to for holiday, gifts for them to take home and for their families, in order to try to reinstill hope in them where they've had everything taken away. Many of these Christian families were middle class. People have the wrong image. Syria and in Iraq, these weren't camels and tents and deserts. These were modern countries. Syria had a higher rate of college educated than the United States. These were modern cities, a dynamic a nation that has absolutely been devastated and destroyed, and the Christians have taken the brunt of it. We do our best, to help the Christian refugees there as best we can. When we don't take any USAID funds, we don't take any EU funds, because if we do, then our aid has to be distributed according to the population, right? And that means that we can only help a very small percentage of the Christians. So we work diligently to help the actual victims of genocide.
I don't want to sound trite, but that's a full-time job. I mean, my goodness. The Christians seem to be, what happened to all of the Christians in Syria? What happened to all of the Christians in Iraq? I mean, genocide, is that what we're saying?
It is genocide. Most of them fled. Oddly enough, right now, Christians are streaming back into Syria. as the government it has apparently won the civil war. Christians are streaming back into Syria. In fact, 600,000 600,000 Syrians have returned to their homes so far this year. Over 60% of those have gone back to Aleppo now that Aleppo is free of the jihadists. But the Christians are not going back to Iraq. They don't see a future in Iraq. And that should tell us something. We've got a constitution there, the new constitution, which says that no law shall violate, Islamic tradition and law. And with that in the constitution as one of the primary, sections of the constitution, Christians are really afraid to go back. The situation is very difficult. It's very, very complex. But this is the root. This is the trunk of the church, the root and trunk of the church. We're the branches over here. This is where, if you recall, Paul was on the road to Damascus. Damascus was the first, where the first great church was outside of Jerusalem. And this is many of the people that we're dealing with are the descendants of Peter and some of the other apostles. They have the blood of those apostles in them, some of them, and they're being driven out of a land that they have managed to stay in for 2,000 years, despite massive oppression by the Ottomans and others. They've managed to stick it out there until now. I feel it's my duty. I can't say it's Americans' duty, and maybe we shouldn't be involved everywhere. But Christians, I think, particularly worldwide, should try to do their best to help the trunk of the tree of Christianity remain in place and not to allow it to be chopped down.
Mr. Murray, how can we in our audience best help your efforts? Just go to your website?
Yes, that'd be good. Our Christmas for Refugees is our next big project, because we have thousands and thousands and thousands of children. We do this every year. And if somebody would like to see just that, go to our ChristmasForRefugees.org and take a look at the information there and see what we did last year, see some of the videos, see what they do and what we do there. And I think they'll appreciate the idea. We're not just handing people gifts. And passing out food or passing out this or that or the other thing. We are trying to reinstill hope and give them a remembrance of what their Christmas was like before they were forced out of their homes. And by the way, it's hard for them to go back. All those homes were looted. Everything's been taken. Every machine from every factory, every piece of furniture from every home, the clothing, the appliances, the fixtures, everything was carted up to Turkey and sold in order to finance the Islamic State's war. And then many of the homes, like in Karakush, Iraq, the Christian homes, they took C4 and they didn't blow it up. They took it and they lit it inside of the homes, causing flames that melted the beams inside of the walls. 75% of the homes in towns like Karakush that were Christian towns in Iraq are not habitable. Schools destroyed, church towers blown off from churches that are hundreds of years old. It gives you a sense of, I can't even describe it. I've walked the streets there. I've looked at it. I've been in the homes. I can't even describe to you the feeling that I have inside, even remembering it. I can't, it's not possible to describe it.
That's, Joe, that says a lot. I mean, to hear that.
And, we've been seeing from the Gulf War to the Arab Spring, the turmoil that has just torn apart the Middle East, and it's unfortunate when you think of what America's role in the destruction of these countries have been. And the amount of loss of life there is unfathomable, and it's only going to continue to get worse. Mr. Murray, if we can come back to the U.S. In the last few minutes we have with you. Again, our guest is William Murray at Utopian Road to Hell. Folks, go to HagmanReport.com. At the top there, you have the WorldNet Daily Superstore. Use promo code Hagman to get the book. Coming back to the U.S., throughout these push towards utopian societies and with these totalitarian systems of government, whether communism or socialism, do you believe that the ideological gap between Americans, do you believe it's as big as the media is promoting it to be? The media will almost have you believe that half the country believes as they do, almost accepting this communist totalitarian type mentality away from the Constitution. Do you believe that as many people, that are almost half the country, is as divided as they say it is?
I believe that probably 70% of the population isn't even involved. But that's a whole other thing. It is the people that pay attention. Half the people that pay attention, are probably with them. I have no idea what that is. I don't even think that a lot of the millennials that are attracted by social media that charge out into the streets for these spontaneous demonstrations really have a good idea of what they're doing there. They're going for some ambiguous thing called social justice. And if somebody wants a lesson on that, they might want to read a book by Friedrich von Hayek called The Constitution of Liberty. It is much more, it is probably the most important book he ever read, because he goes into what happened in by the way, the foundation for Hitler was built by the socialists in Germany. They're the ones that built this social infrastructure, and with all of the agencies and the social agencies and everything else, that when Hitler took over, he was able to almost immediately take over the lives of all of the people very, very quickly because of that infrastructure that they built. That same infrastructure and social infrastructure that is being built here, by the way, and that has been being built since Woodrow Wilson, and is just as bad, just as complex as that was pre-Hitler in Germany. So no, I don't think that they're right. I don't think that they have that big of a following. Unfortunately, I think the biggest problem we have in this country is that more people are watching American Idol than they are paying attention to CNN or Fox.
Boy. Well said.
Well, I'm going to a follow-up question to that. I guess historically, and maybe this will be making history, I'm sure obviously it will at some point, the ideological divide in America, is there any way to find a coming together or reunification, or are we going to see, one side or the other win in the long run?
I'm going to go back to Friedrich Hayek in the Constitution of Liberty for just a second, because he said that the two things that are important for the people. One is for there to be a definable sphere of liberty. And in that sphere of liberty, the people can do what they want to do. They can find the jobs they want. They can run the businesses they want. They can take their money that they earn and they could use it as they want. The problem with the two philosophies, and the reason it's so hard to find middle ground, is because one group wants to expand that sphere of liberty, and the other group wants to shrink that sphere of liberty, with the government and the elitists controlling more and more and making the decisions for individuals inside their sphere of liberty. The other thing that Hayek points out is that we have to have that the most important role of good government, and there has to be some government because there has to be some restraint to criminal activity, is for the rules can be consistent. And that helps to expand that sphere of liberty. And that means that if you go to bed at 5 o'clock on Monday, that if you made money doing something all day on Monday, and you go home and you go to bed, the Tuesday morning, what you did making money on Monday isn't illegal on Tuesday. And we don't have that anymore in our country. We have raging bureaucracies that have been created by Congress that make their own laws. And one day a farmer can plow his field and everything's fine, and the next season he goes to plow it and he's told, no, the ditch over there is a navigable waterway, you can no longer plow your field and you can no longer plant your crop. So we have this fear of liberty getting smaller. But going back directly to your question, I don't see a middle ground between one ideology that believes that sphere should be shrunk because people need controlled in order to make them happy, that they need directed in order to make them happy, and the other group which feels that sphere needs to be increased so that you have the maximum amount of liberty to make your own choices and your own decisions and decide what to do with your own money.
Fantastic.
Very well said.
Fantastic.
One of my favorite quotes in your book, and I'm paraphrasing, is that capitalism distributes opportunity while socialism distributes poverty. And that's not an exact quote, but I just read that in your book. Folks, William J. Murray, The Utopian Road to Hell. Get it at WND Superstore. The link is on the top of HagmanReport.com.
And by the way, he's going to be a speaker at the Act for America rally on 9/11 in Washington, D.C. Is that correct, Mr. Murray?
Well, actually, it's the 9/11 rally, but it's going to be on the 9th.
On the 9th. I'm sorry.
Because the 9/11 will be on a weekday, but it'll be on the 9th, and it is to remember the 9/11. I'll be there. Robert Spencer will be there. A few other individuals, and we will talk about the situation, particularly with regard to we're going to remind people, I think, about who is responsible for the terrorist acts and the United States that kill a lot of people, and it isn't a couple of Nazis in Charlottesville that drive a car into people.
Understood. Got to go, Mr. Murray. I hope you'll come back. God bless you. Thank you so much for your gracious gift of time.
Thank you. God bless you.
All right.
Guys.
Belly of the Beast. Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentations. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood,
Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.